countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
Question on everybody's lips. What is it about Dublin v Kerry? Is it Hill 16 on sunny days in June, or Fitzgerald Stadium with the green and the gold in bloom? Is it Heffo's Heroes or Jacko's Fielding? Is it Paddy's Day in September dreaming? Is it U2 or Tom Cream? Is it Bernard Brogan or Brian Sheen? What is it about Dublin versus Kerry? Is it Kevin Moran or Colm Cooper, or when Paddy Cullen made a blooper? Is it Pints of Black or Kerry Gold? Is it Fortunes Made with Tickets Sold? Is it Molly Malone or Fungi the Dolphin? Is it Ballybunion for the Golfer? What is it about Dublin versus Kerry?
A rivalry above all others.
The distance with the angle, about 45 metres. Here he comes to win the All-Ireland. Buxton, he's put it over the bar!
The Dublin followers numbed into silence by the brilliance, the absolute brilliance of a Kerry team who outmanoeuvred and outsped this Dublin team of champions.
Well, tomorrow at 3:30, Kerry and Dublin will renew old rivalries in the All-Ireland final because they're meeting for the 13th time in the final. Kerry have won 8 of those meetings. Dublin have won 4. Kerry going for their 38th All-Ireland tomorrow. Dublin, they're going for their 29th and, of course, that elusive 5 in a row. So, to look ahead to the All-Ireland final, we thought where better to come but to the Cavan-Monaghan border, to Corduff, just outside Carrickmacross, because I'm here to talk to a man who knows his football. He's been a county manager with Monaghan, with Wexford and with Meath, but he's also a cattle and sheep farmer. Seamus Banty McEnany, good to talk to you. First of all, you're one of the few Monaghan men that appeared in Croke Park on an All-Ireland final day. You were an umpire in 04, was it?
That's correct. Pat was a referee in the All-Ireland final in 2004, and I was umpire under the Canal End, and Kerry was playing Mayo, and it was a rot. The game was over after 15 minutes.
That's right, yeah. And Pat, being your brother, of course, refereed in the famous Meade-Mayo match in 96 as well. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about football in a while, but a lot of people probably don't know that you are primarily a farmer, and we're here in the home place.
Yeah, well, my DNA has been from farming. My father, Lord of Mercy, he died in 1996 and left me the farm back in 1992. I've been farming from I was a dot. You know, it breeds down generations, and you know, your home farm is very special, and we treat it very special. As you've seen, we met my brother Tom there in the Jeep with the dog hanging out the window, and he's doing stock today. But you know, it's a great release. Farming is a great release away from the pressures of business and pressures of football, or whatever the case may be. I love it, absolutely love it. It's been always involved, and I always will be.
Yeah, and we're very much in Drumlin country here. We've climbed to the top of a field here, and we're, as I said, just over a few fields away is the border with Cavan. So you were born on the wrong side of the border.
We would see it here, Damien, that we were definitely born on the right side of the border. The rivalry is fierce between Monaghan and Cavan, as we know. It's known as the Old Firm Derby. Any time they play each other, we're just a mile from Shercock, and there's a wee pub in there in Shercock, Peter Burns's, and we visited on occasions, especially when Monaghan beat Cavan. And to be fair, that has been quite regular over the last few years.
Well, not this year though.
Not until this summer. We had some humble pie to eat in Burns's and Shercock after the Monaghan Cavan game. So we come straight back to Burns's after the game, and we got that over with, and then we could come out the road.
Well, I would think that when you're in Burns, is all you talk about is football and maybe farming, because as I look around here, it's just farming country. And we're in a big field here with your herd of cattle. What do you run here?
Yeah, well, up until last year, we would have had a suckler herd, maybe 100 cows, suckler herd, and we would have taken them to beef. But we've changed that structure in the last 12 months. We now move to bull beef. So we buy in the bull weanlings in July, August, and we put them into the fattening yard, and we killed them off in July, following July.
Right, okay. And was that a big change to make to get rid of the sucklers?
Yeah, no, listen, it was a change that we were probably tempted to do this last 5 or 6 years. And, you know, when we hit the recession, like, we'll never forget the farm, because, you know, when we hit the recession, business became tough, and we started to rely on the farm, believe it or not, for 4 or 5 years, from the year 2010 to 15, probably. The farm was a very, very useful tool to keep our head above water, and it kept our sanity as well. And at that time, we were calving maybe 120 or 30 cows at that time. But listen, business has picked up again, and we've got quite busy, so we had to diversify again.
Yeah, you're in the pub trade, of course, and nightclub business, along with the farming. And for a lot of suckler farmers and beef farmers, they have to have some other form of income. Farmers are at the, as you know, are at the factory gates again this week, getting low prices. Do you sympathise with that?
I certainly do. You know, it's okay getting €3.50 for bulled beef if you're buying accordingly. So if that was the set price over a period of 3 years, at least you could buy accordingly. It's nearly like gambling what we're at. We're buying bull weanlings, we're giving €2.80 a kilo for them live out of the marts, and the next thing is we arrive at €3.40 and €3.50 this week for bull beef. And yeah, I do sympathise with them, but listen, you just have to get on with it. Sometimes you have to dig deep, and sometimes you have to make it. Sometimes you have to change your way of working, change your way of farming. No different than when the recession came in my business, you had to change the way of doing things. And where I would have set a budget of buying our bull beef this year, our bulls in the marts, I set the budget €100 less than we set the budget last year, and we're hoping that that'll see us through.
All right, okay. Well, let's just mention the match then tomorrow. You'll be in Croke Park, of course, and it's a kind of a case. This year, looking at the Dublin team, people are almost saying, well, how much are Dublin going to win by? That suits Kerry, probably doesn't suit Dublin so much, but they're a phenomenal force, and it's very hard to see anything other than a Dublin victory. Are you going to tell me different?
Yeah, no, I don't see anything different. I think that this Dublin team are quite farther ahead than Kerry are. Kerry are, I would have said this 12 months ago, I think Kerry will be winning All Ireland's in maybe 2 or 3 years' time. It takes time for minor teams. I know they've won 5 minors in a row, but that team hasn't materialised with any under-20s or under-21s, albeit that some of their best players are the senior team. But from a Dublin's point of view, I actually hope Dublin win this All-Ireland, believe it or not.
Right.
And the reason is, when Dublin win 5 in a row, they become the greatest Gaelic football team of all time, and I think they deserve that. The way they carry themselves, the way they play their football, like, you know, people say that you know, oh, it's getting boring, and the way they treat the media is boring, and that's all right. That's the way the Jim Gavin runs his show. What I would say is the 15 minutes of the second half against Mayo were some of the best football I've ever seen played in Croke Park. And they, when Dublin play football, they're absolutely fantastic. And now, I wouldn't like to see, I don't want the game destroyed. This is going to be 7 of the last 9 All Ireland titles they've won, so starting to get a bit scary. But we can't forget, before 2011, they'd only won 1 All-Ireland in 25 years. We need the Dubs involved. Gaelic football needs the Dubs involved, but we need somebody else involved very shortly.
All right. Do you see it being a close game, though?
Yeah, listen, I see Kerry coming out of the traps very strong. I've seen it being tight till half-time, but I see Dublin winning this game by 4 or 5 pints plus.
Well, I tell you, it's absolutely gorgeous standing here. It's a little bit windy, but it's a beautiful August day. We're surrounded by lush green fields. It's been a good summer for growth, and lovely cattle here as well. So your two great passions, obviously, football and farming, Seamus.
Absolutely. I live and die for both. And you know, listen, we enjoy. My father, Lord of Mercy, would have been the very same, and he could go to 3 footballs of a Sunday. And, you know, there was the only time when we were growing up, the only time you would ever get away from the farm was if you were going to football. That was the only time you were allowed away.
Well, enjoy the game tomorrow. Thanks very much for chatting to us, Seamus, and the very best of luck in the future.
Thanks, Damien.
Yeah, Seamus Banty McEnany, whose heart is still in farming, looking ahead to tomorrow's All-Ireland final. And yeah, as Brian Carty said there, the Irish News is reporting this morning that he is set to become the next Monaghan football manager. Nothing's been ratified. He did, we didn't talk about it during the week because obviously it was still very much in the melting pot, but it seems that he's the front runner to be ratified at a future meeting of the county board for Monaghan manager, according to that report in this morning's Irish News. That's the signature tune of RTE's Big Week on the Farm you're hearing there, and it's moved from spring to harvest this year. Yes, it's back this week, coming with a subtle move away from life in a busy livestock farm to what a busy time of the year it's like on a tillage and vegetable farm. This year's Big Week will be on a mixed enterprise belonging to Ivan and Frances Curran, who grow potatoes on their farm in Stumullen, County Meath.
They're ton boxes, well, 1.2 ton potato boxes, and we store them. They go in, fill them in the store or off the grader, and they go into the stores, and we store them then seven high in the store.
In the distance, I can see Rockabilly Lighthouse. I can see the City North Hotel. I can see the Irish Sea. It's heaven, lads, and you're going to be on the television screens next week.
We took on more than we bargained for, I think. Chagos put them in touch with us, and they just came to have a look at the place, and then they wanted to go here, and I said, go ahead. I love it because I'll be here my lifetime, but it's a fine place.
I'm originally from Swords, that's in North County Dublin.
Swords.
My own background would be tillage farming as well. We have three children, two daughters and a son. Our eldest daughter, Karina, is married to Conor Maxwell, who's a jockey. Now, they are involved in horses, but they do help out when needs be here in the farm. Our second daughter, Sarah, is a qualified nurse, and she's helping us out here in the farm for the next couple of months because from mid-September on, it can be very, very busy.
Busy time, yeah.
Yep.
Ivan, how much potatoes have you done?
About 650 acres we plant.
Wow.
About 70% of that goes to Tato. 65-70% goes to Taylor, and the rest goes to Denigan, Sam Denigan and company up there, and that goes to Dunn Stores.
How's the Spud Man doing the last couple of years?
Well, the Spud Man this year, I'd say the price will be back a bit. Yields probably be a bit better. Last year was a good year. The year before wasn't so good. The rooster, of course, good washing rooster, will always make nice money, and the crisping end of it is completely unique. It's nearly like growing a different crop. Well, we grow for the crisping market. They don't go for the shelves or Dunn Stores or Denigans. What I'd be growing for Denigans and that wouldn't cross at all. I couldn't sell Christmas stuff into them at all. So you plant in March, April, we do most of our planting.
Patrick's Day traditionally.
Yeah, Patrick's Day. We'd start a little bit earlier here, maybe down next to the coast for early stuff, for potato. It's a very expensive crop to grow. Very expensive on machinery. You have to have... it takes expensive machinery to grow spuds, you know, and harvest them and store them. And
it's just in our blood and it's what we do. And one of Ivan's favourite pastimes is going around the summer evening, digging up and rooting at his potatoes crops to see how they're doing and keeping an eye on them.
Any size at all, the first earlys at all, root them out, bring them home and show them to Francis, like the first every year. But I love going in the evenings in the summer, you're going around and you'll be watching your progress and you know, you get great pride in a good crop. Price is a big thing on it, but even cutting wheat and that, if you're cutting a really good crop, that's what it's about, really, doing the job right and getting good crops, you know.
We step out of the Pink Floyd wall of Ivan Curran potato boxes into the shed where the graders are in action, and there's a lot of noise.
They would have been dug early this morning, and they're grading, going into the bulker and straight over to the tato factory. So they will be in a tato bag now by the end of the day.
Once they come out the back of the bunker, 20 minutes in their crisps, they're in Tato, yeah. By this evening, they'll be in little bags, yeah.
This machine here now is an elevator. What's it doing? It's shooting all the spuds up onto just the trolley.
Just takes the potatoes from the grader. Their size there, any over-sized potatoes are taken out, and then just they're fed into the elevator and they go into the bulkers there. They're 27-ton bulkers there. It just fills the bulker and you can move over and back as you're filling there. That's what it's for. There's a little cleaning system in front of the hopper where you tip in with the trailers. It takes the potatoes across and takes the clay and the clods and that out, and they go to a trailer there for putting back out in the field. You just spread it out in the field again. It goes hell for leather all day, and when we start storing in particular, then it'll be going, yeah, 13-14 hours a day, yeah.
What's the future of potatoes?
You can take or leave pasta. I find no taste in it. Everyone is saying it's good and it's great dietary, but I mean, 99% of people eat pasta, pile on a heap of sauce to make it taste something, and it's probably loaded with whatever, you don't know. I think the biggest problem with potatoes is people don't take the time to cook them anymore.
Yeah.
They're going to have to look at other ways of supplying them that they can be quickly cooked and that.
Would you only boil? Would you boil or roast them?
I steam. Steam potatoes all the time. Uh-huh. Yeah. Or I like a few wedges, so they're nice just to cut up a rooster potato and throw a bit of olive oil on it into the oven. So
would you venture as far as the old Dauphin was or the gratin or any of that kind of stuff?
Oh, you never know. On special occasions, you would do that, yeah. But Ivan's always watching his diet.
Well, signs on the tui. You're a great advertisement for spuds, there's no doubt about it. The spud is good.
I'm very happy to say it, yeah. So, and we're independent, we don't get any help from anyone, we're not dependent on anything, we stand on our own feet really, the potato industry, as you know, it's not like getting any subsidies really or anything like that, so we're on our own.
Lastly, are you concerned about opening your front gate
to the nation's eyes next week?
Don't ask. It's going to be an experience for us, absolutely, yeah. But we'll enjoy it. We'll enjoy it. Kind of, you wake up one day and you say, oh my God, what are we letting ourselves in for? And then you get a wave of excitement, and you kind of, it's a learning curve, and it has been interesting seeing behind the scenes of all the filming and getting to know the producers and directors behind the scenes, and it'll be fun. It'll be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that we're going to enjoy.
There's nothing hidden here. Like, yeah. There's only one thing that makes this work, is getting up at 7 in the morning and working until 10 at night. This time of year, you could cut all night maybe, but the potatoes, certainly when we're putting in the store, we start at 7 in the morning till 9 every night and 5:30 on a Saturday. Bit of maintenance on a Sunday. We try not to work Sunday, give everyone a break. But that's it for till about the last week of October, maybe the first week of November. That's the regime, 7 in the morning till 9 every night. That's the way it goes.
We look forward to seeing it on our screens. Yeah. Ivan and Francis Curran in lovely Stamullen on this glorious Wednesday morning with the Irish Sea in the background. Thanks a million. Well done.
Thank you very much.
That was Brian Laddie reporting from the Curran Farm in Stamullen. And Big Week is on RT1 television, 7 p.m. Monday to Thursday of this week coming. Earlier this month, the National Parks and Wildlife Service reported that 70% of our national habitats are being impacted negatively by some agricultural practices, including ecologically unsuitable grazing and pollution. It follows the Climate Change Advisory Council proposal to reduce the national suckler herd. Indeed, livestock farming is under pressure from ecology and environmental campaigners who say that intensive agriculture is impacting negatively on biodiversity. But all may not be as it seems, because in County Clare, the suckler cow is vital to protecting and nurturing biodiversity. The Burren Life programme provides several hundred suckler farmers with the requisite support to continue grazing their suckler cows in an environmentally sustainable way.
Burren at its finest now, Damien. Here.
Absolutely. I'm here in the Burren in North County Clare.
So this farm, just as to give you an introduction to it, is kind of, the farmer here has done an awful lot of work.
It's rocky limestone land, which has been farmed for over 5,000 years.
What a way of that scrub, which allows the species which grass them to thrive. So you can see all the colour there at the minute.
And on first impressions, it's as if this landscape hasn't changed a lot in that time.
So bringing the farm back to life, so to speak, because without farming you wouldn't get the same level of biodiversity here otherwise.
Wildflowers grace these small rugged fields in raging colours, and cows grace these fields in partnership with nature. It's the only place in the world which is grazed all year round, in the valleys and lowlands for the summer months, and up the Burren Hills for winter, or during the winterage as it's called.
There's a fascinating story of farming here. It goes back almost 6,000 years.
Brendan Dunford is the founder of Burren Life, which allows farmers, flora, fauna and this landscape exist in a sustainable and vibrant way.
Some of the oldest farm structure built in Ireland is here in the Burren, and it continues to the present day. But today we have maybe up to 1,000 farm families in the Burren. They're mainly specialising in suckler beef production. The weanlings are sold, good quality weanlings sold here at March, October, November every year, and then the cows are put back here on what we call the winterage grasslands. So the cattle spend the winter, the mothers spend the winter out here on these grasslands foraging, and they do quite well. Some of them calve out, others then are brought home to calve, and then in summertime they're moved to the spring grass, to lowland grasslands, to spend the summer down there.
Now, as you said, it's a kaleidoscope of beautiful colours where we stand. It's rugged stone in between lush grass and lots of flowering as well at this time of the year. You told me on our way up here that this is made possible by farming here.
Yeah, it's a combination of farming and nature at its very best. So you have these lovely limestone grasslands, which have been farmed for almost 6,000 years, according to this unique system of winter grazing. And really, that's critical, because we've shown by research that if you reduce farming, which is what's happening at the moment, is that you get a lot of native woodland species starting to take over again. So take farming out and scrub and woodland starts to take over again, which in some ways is wonderful. But when you do get that happening, as you can see around here, you lose an awful lot of your floral diversity. So of these lovely grasslands depend on continual grazing. The monuments here beside me, if they become encroached or covered with trees and woodland, they're liable to collapse, and the whole landscape starts to change. So, to my mind, Ireland's landscape and the Burns landscape is at its best when it's been farmed sustainably. So what we'd love to see here as a future, and what we're trying to promote through the Burn programme, is sustainable farming in a way that produces great quality beef, produces amazing biodiverse grasslands, sustains its geology and archaeology, and keeps our amazing community of people here in the Burn and the traditions they've upheld for thousands of years, that they're maintained in the future. That's what we want for the future of the Burn.
Oliver, how are you?
Damien.
You're welcome to Cannon.
In Pollock Carron, in the heart of the Burren, yeah, Oliver Nagel grazes 20 cows on about 80 acres.
We call it down this the outside farm.
This is the outside farm.
This is the outside
but this
farm,
where your father, grandparents, the,
that's
this is
correct,
the home farm.
Yeah. This is my father's mother's father's farm.
Right.
Now
right.
It is my farm.
Right. So how important is it to you that you're able to continue on farming here?
It's a gift, really, to be able to get our hands dirty in a place like this. Any place I make an improvement, I look back, it's there forever with right. maintenance.
Yeah.
You know, the people before us, they built the wedge tombs, they left their fingerprints. The people before them, they built the big cahars, the souterrains, and we're here today, and what we're doing is we're looking after what they built. My farming is sustainable. I didn't have to build a slatted house. I'm not cutting hay. I'm not making silage. I can do all this with what the Lord gives us. We're not doing harm. What we are actually doing is we're creating a landscape that was already here before, until agricultural policy that changed in the early 80s stopped us from looking after our farms. The plan today is looking after the farm. It's looking after the cow, and it's looking after the man that's looking after all of us.
Down the road, I meet another local farmer, John Marnin.
It's a lovely locally made gate today.
It is, yeah. Hello, John.
Hello, Damien. How are you doing?
How are you, John? Good.
Good, Damien.
Is this your farm here? Nice.
So we have a very unique grazing system here on the Burn. I suppose we're the only place in the world where we can outwinter our cattle for the 12 months of the year. So they're grazing outside for the 12 months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
We have what we call winterage and summerland. So the cattle are on the summerland for the 6 months of the summer, and they move up onto the winterages in the 1st of November for the winter grazing. So they get to roam the winterages, they're fit cows, and just a brilliant system.
But you're able to obviously produce good quality cattle on this
yes.
terrain.
Yes, we can produce the best cattle, not boasting, we can produce the best cattle in the world on the Burn.
And as I said, there's lots of colour, because biodiversity here seems to be thriving, despite the fact that it is livestock country. How can that happen?
Yes, it's very good quality land. You have the dense woodland, like inside the wall here now. You have yeah. dense woodland, mature woodland. So they are very vital things. The colour, the flora that we see here today, it's a huge variety of different flowers and plants grown here in the Burn. So it's all down to the grazing system. Our suckler cow grazes down these winterage, these wild grasses, really hits them hard on the springtime to graze out all the grasses so the flowers can flourish. So that's why we have this brilliant array of colour here at the moment.
It's important to recognise that there are a lot of negative stories around farming, but there's a lot of farming heroes across the country as well who are doing amazing things for nature. Sometimes economic signals in the marketplace determine that farmers have to push nature maybe in ways that they shouldn't and don't want to. But I think most farmers that I've met here over the years, and have great time for them, have a real love of their place, of the natural values of their place, of the history and the archaeology. And I think that pride of place is a great resource looking to the future when we're talking about the Irish landscape and the Irish heritage and biodiversity.
That's Brendan Dunford of Burren Life speaking to me in the beautiful Burren in County Clare during the week. Now, just 10 years ago, would you believe it, Ryan Tubridy took over at the helm of the Late Late Show on RT1 television, and the following morning a new programme called Countrywide set sail here on Radio 1. On that very first programme in 2009, Dara McCullough and Catherine O'Leary were among our first guests, and they join me now. Again, 10 years on, we're all a bit older and wiser, but where is Irish agriculture? agriculture in rural Ireland at now, 10 years down the line, and where will it be in 10 years' time? I hope you can tell us. You're looking great, the two. You look better now. Decade on.
Happy birthday, Damien.
Thanks very much. I was just listening back to that first programme a decade ago, which you were both on, and there was a lot of negativity and doom and gloom, particularly around dairy farming in particular. It was the end of the road.
Yeah.
Farmers are getting out of business and the price was on its knees. Now it's the beef farming. So the more things change, the more they stay the same, Catherine, it seems. Farmers remain price takers, not price makers.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, the product price is the thing that defines farming in every sector.
Yeah.
You know, I was even talking to a grain farmer last night and he was saying that this year he has had a much higher yield but a poorer price than last year, you know, and less money in the pocket. And I think, you know, the story is good for dairying at the moment. Back in 2009, I mean, it was a terrible year, the doom and gloom that year, the prices on the floor. I had a son doing Leaving Cert. Colin was doing his Leaving Cert. You know, the pressures of that kind of thing. There was a lad in his class who committed suicide. There was, you know, or died by suicide. There was such pressure trying to make ends meet. And
now we were in the midst of a national recession then.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. But like, you have to think about the beef families now that are being affected by this.
Well, I'm just wondering, Dara, like 10 years before that, around 2000, there was the beef blockade, the original beef blockade, which people might have forgotten about, the IFA, the big fines in court and all of that. And now we're back at that situation once again. Is there a chink of light there for the beef farmers when you look at dairy farming 10 years ago on its knees and now dairy farmers are flying it? Doesn't it go in cycles?
Absolutely. And Catherine mentioned grain last year. There was fantastic prices for grain. This year they're lower. Milk has gone seesawing over the last 10 years. And, you know, beef... Like, there was never a fortune in beef, right? But I think there will be a future for beef farmers out there. Maybe not all the ones that we have today, but there'll certainly be a future and there'll be better times ahead.
Okay. Yeah. We might come back to the beef thing in a moment, but if I was to bring you back to 2009, and if I had said to you then, I didn't think we'd be on the air for a year, let alone 10 maybe at that stage. But if I said, look, we'd be back in 2019, what will the big changes be? Would you have envisaged where we are now, Catherine, as much change?
Oh, absolutely not. We wouldn't. And I think that's the blue sky thinking. It's really hard to envisage what might happen in the future. I suppose the change in diets, the flexitarian and vegan diets, that kind of thing, and how it's going to impact farming in the future. The whole climate change plan and future, and how, I suppose, the public now want to know where their food is coming from much, much more than they did before. You could touch on animal welfare. There's so many things that probably we didn't see that would be making big headlines now. But then you have science changing, changing
technology.
Everything and technology. I mean, everybody now has a smartphone in their pocket. I mean, that is a huge change that has come. We would not have seen that. I mean, and like, you have all your records, you have everything on the farm. It does so much for you now. You know, you couldn't have envisaged that.
I remember stepping out fields to try and measure, you know, was that 150 metre long stretch, or, you know, getting the widths on the fertiliser spreader. Nobody does that anymore because, number one, you've got GPS in your tractor cab measuring to the closest inch or 2 centimetres.
Was that not maybe there before 2009?
It was if you could afford it. Like, this was military grade stuff back 10 and 20 years ago. Mm. And now it comes almost standard on big tractors these days.
But just getting back, Dara, to what Catherine talked about there, you know, in 2009, if we said, you know, in 10 years' time, flexitarianism, veganism, climate change issues, having to reduce the national herd, being talked about, all of this, you probably would have laughed and said, that's real green, sandal wearing sort of thinking. But it is happening, and I'm not sure if farmers were ready for it, because they're getting such a kicking online, for example, that they haven't been able to respond. Obviously, the farming and agriculture sector didn't envisage it.
Yeah, I think, look, the straws were on the wind 10 years ago. I remember writing a piece about eating more couscous and pasta at home than spuds 10 years ago. And I got a few raised eyebrows for it. But it was already happening then. then that, you know, that diets were changing. And, you know, animal welfare isn't a new thing and the environment isn't a new thing. But what I think has happened is that it's intensified. And social media, as you're talking about there, has been part of that intensification. So suddenly now people can take a picture or a video and it's up online. And if it goes viral, everybody...
And maybe out of context as well.
Yeah, or it can be... and look at... Forever and a day, people can spin a story a certain way.
Yeah.
And so we need to be so careful now about trying to read and understand the truth behind the stories.
As a farmer, Catherine, you yourself and Tim are farming there in Cork with a family. Do you feel under attack somewhat? I mean, you're dairy farmers and the expansion of the dairy herd has been criticised.
Yeah, but the biggest game changer for us was definitely the abolition of quota. You know, that's the huge change that caused...
In the last 10 years. Yeah,
that caused us to be where we are now. I mean, back in 2009, we had a son just after doing his leaving cert. Yes, he was heading into dairy business. There's another new change with agriculture, you know, for the actual education of people has changed in agriculture completely. And he went in to do dairy business. I'm not sure Colm would have come back home to farm. He would be in the agricultural business, but I'm not sure he would have come back home to farm if quotas hadn't been abolished and if we could expand. So the expansion has taken place, and you say Tim and I are farming. We're farming in partnership with Colm. That's very much the three of us. We've taken on a second unit. Colm is now in his own right on a second unit, and we're in such a different place to what we were in 2009. And I think this is important too for the beef farmers and so on. There's so much change going on all of the time. But as Dara says, we have to be completely ready. But I think the farmers are responding to climate change. I mean, we're waiting for, I suppose, that real direction. But we are getting direction from Chagosk, and there is a plan. And I think as science changes and gets better, we will respond. I mean, farmers have always responded to change.
Maybe not quick enough, maybe in some people's eyes.
But maybe not quick enough. But like, we've been doing things like using protected urea for the last 3 years. You know, the trailing shoe, all of this stuff.
Yeah, trailing shoe to minimise their two methods of reducing the emissions from agriculture.
And how much of a game changer has been the abolition of milk quotas, Dara, in farming in this country?
In a word or in a sentence, if you ask me what's the biggest change in Irish agriculture over the last 10 years, it's been dairying. It's not been beef or wheat or smartphones or anything like that. It's been dairying. So 10 years ago, dairy farming was shackled and depressed. Mm. Now it has expanded by 50% in that time. It's created opportunities for the likes of Catherine O'Leary's son and countless others all over the country. There's kind of competing stories about what kind of result or impact this has had on Irish agriculture. Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? I think it is definitely a positive. Mm. And yet there is this kind of narrative that, the expansion of the dairy herd has generated more emissions, which is true. It's polluting the countryside, which is not. And that it's... You know, this is a new type of landlordism that's taken over the country, which is nonsense. So this is more the going back to the social media and the kind of messages that are coming out from our Irish agriculture. I think it's really important that we maintain perspective. Dairy farming is the one that's paying the bills in the vast majority of villages out there
Absolutely,
in rural Ireland.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, how has outside the farm gate 10 years ago the phrase "rural Ireland is dying," the decline of rural Ireland, probably even 20 years ago that was being talked about, still there, is it, Catherine?
Well, I think especially where in dairy areas, villages have certainly recovered, and there's a lot of jobs has come into various towns, particularly all the Cork villages and towns with factories and all the people that are working and so on. And that expansion has been really good. I think I can't ever see rural Ireland dying, and I don't think farmers will ever let it die. There will always have to be farmers, even if food changes. Well,
and
it's still the farmers are growing it.
And
you
even
know?
If we have robots in the fields, basically autonomous tractors, which is going to happen. I was on a farm in Holland during the summer, and he had these weed or sprayer machines that were basically solar panels on wheels and a little jet underneath them, and it was going around the field spraying weeds. It was a way of reducing chemical input on the crop by 99%, and it was also a way of minimising labour. The problem was that they cost 75 grand each. Yeah. But they will, in the same way that, you know, the technology in your phone would have cost thousands 10 years ago and now costs hundreds or maybe 50 quid. That's the way technology is going to go on farms as well. But that doesn't mean that the countryside is going to be empty. You know, people go, oh God, Dara, does that mean there's going to be nobody on farms anymore? Nonsense. You know, if you look at a dairy farm that has robots milking the cows, it's not that the farmer doesn't have to get out of bed in the morning and manage stuff. He still has to get out check the stock. The robots will do a certain amount, but you still have to...
But there's not that many of them. You know, at the end of the day, back in 2009, there was very few robots. I don't think there's that many. You know, we would have imagined a bigger growth in that,
I think.
I think
there's about 400 dairy farms around the country now that have robots, which is a pretty impressive number.
And they would be big operations milking.
But they have.
Not necessarily. You can have just 70 cows on a robot. So, and actually, in some ways, it suits the guy that wants to work off farm. So the robots will keep milking the cows during the day and he can tug out in the morning and back in the evening.
It's not as simple as that.
I know, it's never simple.
He'll be getting a phone call to say the robot has stopped. Yeah. What does he do then?
Well, look, we didn't get through everything that I wanted to talk about, but we do have a minute left. And I suppose if I was to ask both of you to come back here in 10 years' time, apart from Dublin, the surety that they'd be going for 15 in a row at that stage, that's been the only certainty we have then. In farming, what will be the big talking points then, Catherine? 30 seconds.
Oh, gosh, it's really hard to tell. I imagine we haven't an idea what way it will be like, but I hope that I would have a grandson or a granddaughter farming.
You'd be confident.
In Woodside. I'd be confident, yes. I think it's a fabulous way of life and we have to value it and protect it and work for it.
Ireland will still be producing food, and the hope should be that we are a niche premium producer.
Will we be producing as much beef and dairy?
I think we'll certainly be producing as much milk. Will we be producing as much beef? I doubt it somehow, but I think the beef that we will be producing will be more valuable, will be a more premium product and a more valued product. And it's going to have to be the most environmentally friendly beef on the planet. That's the only way for it to survive.
All right, it's been a joy having you in again, and I'm sure we'll chat to you on over in the years ahead if we're here, please God. Both of you, of course, obviously Dara, contributor to Ear to the Ground and to the Farming Independent, and Catherine, a weekly columnist in Country Living in the Farmers Journal, as well as both of you coming from dairy backgrounds. Thank you both very much for joining us and happy birthday to us all. All right, well, back to the weekend that is in it, and tomorrow's All-Ireland final. For those lucky to have a ticket, it will be an epic day, even more so for those attending their very first All-Ireland. Seamus O'Rourke now recalls his first All-Ireland final.
In 1980, I was 15. I was big for my age, but had never been to an All-Ireland final. I'd been to masses all, and a school hop, but nothing ever happened at the school hop because the world had come to a sudden stop just out the road from our house. Must have had a puncture. Then my sister got a job in Dublin, moved to a bedsit out in Crumlin, or was it the North Circular Road? She was working for the P&T, and she rang to see if the brother and me would chance going to Dublin to the All-Ireland football final. Well, of course we'd go. Roscommon were playing Kerry, and Kerry were heading for 3 in a row. And we were right nervous about staying away, because we had never stayed away till now. We had stayed up the odd night with a calf and cow, but apart from that, and the whole chat was about our first All-Ireland weekend and how we'd get. We had never been on a proper bus. We used to get a yellow bus to school, but the bus to Dublin was less yellow, and the driver, he was a different fella to the lad that drove our bus. Probably didn't use his bus for bringing calves to the mart. So on Friday, the old lad left us to Cavan, left us in the hands of CIE, and I smiled at the brother and he to me. But we'd forgot the bags we were supposed to bring, and neither of us had a single thing to wear that weekend. We'd have to do with what we had on. Oh, no. We landed above in Dublin, and the sister brought us out to Crumlin or wherever she was. We sat in the bedsit and then lay down. It was a very small flat for Dublin town and a pair of young lads with no change of clothes. Me sister had the single bed, and me and the brother just laid our heads on the floor and shared the hum of the fridge. On Saturday, there wasn't much to do, so the sister brought us out to Dublin Zoo, but they wouldn't take us. They said it was too late to let us in, so we went home and lay beside the fridge again. We couldn't get over the crowd on Sunday. We had never seen such a crowd at Mass. I prayed at Mass, as I always did. I prayed for Roscommon and their bid for All-Ireland glory. I prayed for a dry day, but mostly I prayed for Dermot Early, that his light might shine, and that so might mine if I ever got to play in Croke Park. But God must have been to the zoo that morning, because Mass was followed by a weather warning, and I never got to play that game, and me and the brother were drenched with rain, as Roscommon fought bravely, and Kerry the same. And it was the same result as the 2 years before. Kerry won, and everyone said it's becoming a bore. And me and the brother, without a fuss, sat in our damp clothes going home on the bus. And then 39 years did quickly pass, and we're still going to football and the odd times Mass. But I'll never forget my first trip away, and All-Ireland magic and the need to pray. A weekend like it, there is no other. And the hum of the fridge, and me, and the brother.
And you know, 1980 happened to be my first All-Ireland final too, but I didn't get wet. I was sitting in under the old Nally stand that wet Sunday. Let's hope for better weather tomorrow, and good luck to Dublin and Kerry. Seamus will be appearing in a new play, An Oge's Brose by John McManus, which comes to the Dolman Theatre, Cornell's Court, from September the 17th through to the 20th. Details on SeamusO'Rourke.com.